Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Gear 30 on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, and you can check out everything we're doing and reviewing and talking about over at blisterreview.com and our YouTube channel. Just look up Blister Review over on YouTube, where yesterday we posted a great conversation about ski design and the state of U.S. manufacturing. So you can check that out over on our YouTube channel. And what we've got for you today, right now, is another great conversation from our Blister Summit. This one is on the current state of helmet tech, and we get a bit of an update on what we've learned about head injuries and, importantly, what the current best practices are for all of us skiers and snowboarders. And hosting this conversation is our own Blister reviewer, Sasha Anastas, because Sasha is a physician assistant with lots of years and lots of experience spent in an ER room treating head injuries. So I thought she would be a great person to lead this particular conversation. And to cover all of this stuff with Sasha are Stephen Kennedy from Giro, Frederick Schelberg from MIPS, and Solomon skier Drew Peterson. Because if you aren't familiar with Drew's story already, well, Drew is very, very familiar with both significant head injuries and the importance of helmets, and you will hear more about that in this conversation. This episode of Gear 30 is presented by our Blister-recommended shop, Boone Mountain Sports, located in Evergreen, Colorado. And you really ought to make it out to Evergreen on April 6th for their Uller's Boone Voyage blowout sale. That's really a mouthful, you Boone brothers. The Uller's Boone Voyage blowout sale, which is running from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. on April 6th, where you will score incredible deals on top ski brands, apparel, and accessories. So don't miss this chance to stock up on gear and save big for your next mountain escapade. And in other incredibly cool news, Boone Mountain Sports is sponsoring Icelantic's Return to the Rocks Snow Sports Concert at Red Rocks Amphitheater, featuring performances by The Ice Cube, Bone Thugs and Harmony, The Game, and Living Legends. That event promises to be an unforgettable experience. And all customers who spend $50 or more with Boone from March 16th to April 6th will automatically be entered to win two free tickets to Return to the Rocks. And fittingly, they are going to draw the winners on April 6th at the Uller Boone Voyage blowout sale. You see how this is all connected, folks? So anyway, don't miss out on that incredible concert or the Boone Voyage sale. So clearly, folks, Boone Mountain Sports is not just a ski shop. They are a community of outdoor enthusiasts dedicated to helping you make the most of your adventures with expert tuning services, personalized shopping experiences, and a passionate team ready to assist you. They will ensure that you are fully equipped on your next journey into the great outdoors. So mark your calendars for April 6th, and don't forget to spend $50 or more for your chance to win tickets to Icelantic's Return to the Rocks Snow Sports Concert. And remember, your next unforgettable adventure starts at Boone Mountain Sports. And now, let's talk helmet tech, head injuries, and best practices. Sasha Anastas, take it away.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here for this last panel session. I am excited to be here as well as with our panelists. Our goal tonight is to do a bit of a state of the union on helmet technology in regards to head injuries. Given that, I'm going to kind of briefly introduce our panelists. We have Frederick Schelberg, who is Chief Marketing Officer at MIPS.
That would be me.
We have Stephen Kennedy, Director of R&D at Giro. And we also have Drew Peterson, professional skier for Solomon. So in the interest of time, I'm going to start with you, Frederick, here. And I'm going to jump right into it. And I just want to really look at what is the problem that BIPs helmet technology is addressing, and where did it all come from?
Yeah, it's actually a kind of a nice story how it all came around. And it also addresses why we do the product that we do. It was a brain surgeon in Sweden who, some 25 years ago, he noticed that bicycle helmets became rather popular in Sweden, and people who came in having a crash and wearing a helmet, they came in and basically the skull fractures were gone, but the brain injuries and the concussions remained. So he thought it was a bit odd, of course. They had been wearing a helmet, and obviously it didn't look like their brains were protected. So he dove deeper into this topic, and he found some rather old research, actually, that suggested that the brain is much more sensitive to rotational motion than to linear hits. So what that essentially is, that when you fall, you don't crash down straight like this, but you come with a bit of speed, and your head will catch the ground, set your a little spin to your head that will transfer into your brain, and thus the brain stretches. So he realized that that was the issue, but he was a surgeon, so he had no clue basically how do we solve this technically. So he went to the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, and he found a guy there who was rather young and at the start of his career, and was supposed to do something completely different. But he said, that sounds like a nice challenge to figure out an idea here. So they started working on it. And what they saw is that our brains are actually floating around in our head in a fluid. And if I knock my head back and forward like this, my brain will slide 10 to 15 millimeters. And that is what evolution has given us to pick up these forces when we fall. And it works great when you walk or run, maybe. But when you bring up the speed on a pair of skis or on a bike, those forces will be stronger and you need extra protection. So they came up with the idea of having a sliding layer inside the helmet that adds another 10 to 15 millimeters of this motion. So that's how it all came about, and they thought they had a great idea, and they said, let's make a helmet. And some of the early investors were into equestrian, so we make an equestrian helmet. Said and done, they brought it to market, they sold 3,000 helmets, it was a great success, until the Swedish fall came around, and the plastic that they had used for the neck retention system, which actually doesn't have anything with the protection in the helmet to do, it was rather cheap quality, and it became brittle in the cold and basically broke. And that almost broke the entire company, because they had to make a callback for 3,000 helmets. That's rather expensive. And along came a bunch of investors who said, okay, guys, we're going to save you from this, and we're going to invest in you, but you guys are not good at making helmets. You have a great product. Keep doing that. You become an ingredient brand, and we sell this to different helmet manufacturers. And yeah, that's how it all came around. And as you asked for, that's also what the problem we're trying to solve. And
how many years ago did his research start?
He came around this 25 years ago.
So the research and technology has been evolving for the past 25 years.
It's been on the market for, you probably know better, because Giro was one of the first takers, but
it sounds about right.
Yeah.
So one of the main differentiations is the difference between a skull fracture and a concussion. And it can be tricky defining these, and they exist on a spectrum. Maybe Stephen, as like a helmet brand, can you tell us like how you design helmets that kind of account for these two different injury types?
Sure. So the snow ski snowboard standard, the ASTM standard, that's designed to prevent skull fracture at a certain impact speed. So there's a drop height that has a velocity of 6.2 meters per second, about 14 miles an hour, and a certain threshold that you have to pass in order to sell a helmet in the United States, and that's designed to prevent skull fractures. So most helmets, well, essentially any helmet that's sold in the US will prevent skull fracture below a 14 mile per hour impact. So past that, that's where you get into concussion mitigation. And so the challenge is you have this hard line of preventing skull fractures, and you have design parameters that you have to achieve in order to hit that test standard. And then you have to go one step further and say, okay, how do we then mitigate as many concussions as we can? And there's two sides to that. There's your linear impact management, which is what the test standard tests for, where you have a flat drop height on a flat anvil. And then you have the rotational element of it. And that's where MIPS comes into play in mitigating the rotational acceleration with the MIPS LFL layer.
And Drew, I know you've dived deep into the topic as well. I know you've attended sports medicine conferences. Do you have anything to add just on the differentiation between the skull injury and concussion, even anecdotally in your own experience?
Yeah, I think it's important to note, like, both anecdotally through my experience, but then also for the sport. Like, mostly we're talking about skiing and snowboarding here, and when we're thinking about, like, why are we wearing helmets, most of us are probably thinking concussion number one, but then it's really important to understand those skull fracture, like, standards that we're trying to meet. For a lot of reasons, like, you know, so many of us, like, the real reason a helmet's going to save our lives is preventing a skull fracture, like, if we hit a tree or something. But then, like, also, like, on a personal level, like, the biggest reason that I wear a helmet in the spring is because of the danger of rockfall. And that is a very real danger in ski mountaineering. And personally, I've had two severe head injuries and a number of other concussions along the way as well. And the first of those severe head injuries was a rockfall accident where I just had the worst luck in the world and the best luck in the world on the same day, where across the span of an entire volcano on Mount Hood, the first sign, the first sound, and the first rock that we know that fell that day fell from a cliff about 40 feet above me while I was transitioning my skis. And I hit the deck, turtled over, because that's what I've been trained to do and my whole lifetime in backcountry skiing, and a rock about the size of a microwave fell from probably about 40 feet above me, and it landed directly in the back of my head, on my neck, on the middle of my upper back, and then on my left arm. And I 100% would not be here today. I would not be alive if it were not for the fact that I was wearing a helmet, and the reason I was wearing a helmet was because of the danger of rockfall. So on the skull fracture level, the danger is very real when we're talking about skiing and snowboarding. And then on the concussion mitigation side, and when we're talking about rotational impacts, like, I also have personal experience there, and I think that this probably, like, explains, like, how real these risks are for those of us who are out there. Is, like, the other severe head injury I had was kind of the reverse role. I hit a rock. I don't know if ironically is the right word, but I believe it was from the visual and balance deficits from the prior head injury, that I just had this, like, weird little mistake where I caught my tip and it hooked me into a rock wall. And that one, I really believe, I was wearing a MIPS helmet at the time, and I really believe that the rotational impact of that was mitigated to some degree by MIPS. And, like, when we're talking about these things, like, it's not like a, you know, like, 100%, it's gonna like stop everything. And, like, but my experience was that it was enough to mitigate that rotational force, and, you know, again, probably mitigate a skull fracture. And, you know, that one, maybe I could have survived, but I don't get into those ifs or whens. But I'm here today, and I'm a huge proponent of, you know, these conversations, but also of the cultural shift that we've seen in skiing and snowboarding, where it's expected, it's cool, and it's very normal to be wearing a helmet. And big credit to manufacturers and the technology that we're bringing in to, you know, hopefully keep more of us safe.
So either one, Frederick or Steven, mm-hmm. If we were to reverse it and take Drew's anecdotal experience and kind of take that to what you guys are doing and how you guys are researching oblique injuries versus more straight-on directional injuries. How and what are you guys doing on the R&D side of things?
So I can jump on that one. So right now, like as I said, in the actual snow standard, there's no oblique impact in that standard. So Amazon helmets, anything that's sold on the market, they just need to pass this linear impact test. So it's really on the manufacturers to say, how do we go above and beyond what's mandated to mitigate these rotational impacts? And there's a couple of different ways we do that. There's a new European moto helmet standard that does have a rotational impact to it. So we, like on both on the bike and snow side, we look to more stringent standards to try and pull from there and say, how do we go above the bare minimum and kind of achieve these higher level standards? And then the other side is with MIPS. They've developed their own internal standard that we work with on every MIPS helmet to make sure that it's passing the MIPS standard to mitigate that rotational impact.
Did you want to add anything, Peter?
No, I can 100% agree to what Steven is saying, but also the way we test helmets at MIPS is really, we are solely focusing on when we do the test, our test protocol to pass the MIPS test, that is 100% focused on the rotational. We take a helmet without the MIPS system and we take a helmet with the MIPS system. And then we drop them into this angled anvil. So you get the rotational component in, and then we can see that we reduce the rotational motion significantly with the MIPS system, and then we can approve the helmet. Then we, of course, do tons of research with linear hits and so as well, because the linear hits are also an issue. It's not that they are not harmful for your brain. So,
yeah, and I think that's the biggest challenge for us is if you could tell us exactly the impact speed, direction, velocity of the crash that you're going to have, we could design the perfect helmet for that, right? But looking at not only the worst case scenario, but the most likely case scenario, and how is someone likely going to crash, whether they're an 8-year-old learning to ski for the first time, or somebody ski mountaineering going 45 down a couloir. So there's a lot of different input in terms of how we design helmets and who we design helmets for. And making sure that it's not just worst case scenario, but also likely scenario.
So in other words, Giro goes above and beyond the standard that's required. And then in addition to that, MIPS is also holding themselves to another standard. So you guys have your internal standards, safety standards based on your own R&D. And then you're buying a Giro helmet with a MIPS insert, and that has its own standard. So you guys have like far surpassed any sort of snow standard. Is there any other than the European standard that is holding the companies more liable, I guess you could say? Is there any sport in the United States that's doing that now?
So I think the sport to highlight is cycling and the Virginia Tech standard. So right now in the cycling space, everyone is aware of the Virginia Tech standard. The market demands a 5-star helmet across the board. And so that gives us, for people who aren't familiar with the Virginia Tech standard, it's a third-party rating system where they're ranking all our helmets, all the Salomon helmets, as what they deem to be safest across the board. And so on the cycling side, that's our bar, right? And the new Giro road cycling helmet that just launched, number one ranked helmet on the cycling side for Virginia Tech. On the snow side, they have a slightly different standard, and there's a bit of debate on this and how much we agree with the standard from a MIPS standpoint, because when they test for rotational impact, the anvil they use on the road side or on the cycling side has sandpaper on it. So that's replicating an impact where you hit your head on the road. On the snow side, it's a steel anvil. So it's kind of replicating snow or ice, which in some cases is probably your most likely scenario. But if you look at hitting your head on a rock or hitting your head on a tree, that's a completely different impact. And so how they test may be not totally agreed on by everyone, but it's that challenging of different brands, different companies, we're all trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to design the safest helmets we can. And so pushing each other to improve the Virginia Tech standard and then have Giro have the number one helmet, then Salomon comes in, they have the number one helmet, then we have the number one helmet. And it kind of, rising tide lifts all boats.
Drew, out in the field and as an athlete, what would be kind of like your insight on how these guys are running the safety requirements and their standards? What do you see their safety standards as representative of the injuries you've sustained or possibly could sustain?
I'm really good at hitting my head. So I don't know if any manufacturer standard gets up to mine, but you know, there's a lot of like interesting aspects to that. I think that you know, number one is we are counting on manufacturers when we're talking about certainly skiing and snowboarding, but action sports, non-mainstream sports basically, because we don't have the advent of millions of dollars from the NFL to research helmets. And like you said, like we don't know the exact forces that are going to like come at our heads. In like the difference there is like for traditional team sports, they actually do know that to some degree. I mean, they're using like Amazon's AI to track all of the different forces on every NFL football tackle this year to figure out where like the greatest tension is, and they're doing that for the helmets as well. And we don't have that money. So it's really important that manufacturers are going above and beyond and are creating those like much greater standards. You know, as far as like what that impact is gonna be like on our practice out there is like, we'll never know. Ultimately, like, that's the best case scenario, is that we'll never know what those standards are, because if they keep setting them higher, and you know, hopefully we get lucky like I did.
Yeah, and I think to his point on the NFL, the reason they have so much data is because there's so much video of all those impacts, right? And so every single like illegal hit, there's all this video data, and there's tons of analysis you can do on that. And that's what we don't have, right? Because you're somebody's by themselves or behind somebody else, and you crash, and you don't know. And so there's one project that we're working on this summer to put crash test sensors in our rental helmets. So we'll have, this is actually on the bike side, but we'll have a rental fleet of helmets with crash test sensors, and then we will have some data, and we can look at that and figure out how people are crashing. Are they hitting rocks? Are they hitting dirt? Are they sliding? How much rotational impact is there? How much linear impact is there? And so it's not on the scale of the NFL, because yeah, we don't have NFL money, but we're doing what we can on that side to learn as much as we can and inform our decisions about the helmets that we make.
Frederick, do you have anything to add?
I think it's really cool what you talk about also with this sensors and trying to
you
find
know
out.
About that. That's with, yeah, Quinn that you guys invested in. So that's, yeah, a three-way partnership, yeah, on that one.
Yeah. But also what we have at MIPS is we have a brain model where we have virtually built up the brain in a computer model over 25 years. So we believe it to be very, very accurate. And we have, speaking of when you accidentally film something, because we need to validate that model, that is the brain model in the computer actually acting as the brain would? And very rarely we have footage of the accidents. But there is one case, for example, where we have a motocross incident where one guy gets, is it whiskey throttle it's called in English, right? Much less entertaining word in Swedish. But one guy comes, he gets a whiskey throttle on a jump and comes out and hits the guy who is leading the race. Straight. We have footage of this then from two directions, and it's a vicious hit. But we got the helmet, so we can see the impacts on the helmet. We have the two angles of film, which is important to judge the speed and the forces. And then we could build the entire motorcycle. And actually, he was lucky because he was hit by the front fender. So that took a bit of the impact out. Had he been hit by the fork or the wheel, he'd be dead. But anyhow, we could then remodel this in the computer, and we got the brain scan from him afterwards. And then we could match that. We did a simulation in the computer and looked at his brain scans and the images. And then we could verify that this brain model is really replicating what's happening live, because the injuries in the brain model appeared exactly at the same positions in his head as the scan.
Yeah, you touched on a really, I think, interesting and important topic to think about as far as studying the topic. You can't really just run, from a medicine standpoint, a bunch of random control trials, right? You can't just put helmets X, Y, and Z on, you know, three or, you know, ideally hundreds of people and have them go ram their heads and sustain these head injuries. So it is tricky. You do have to spend a lot of time relying on computer models or, you know, R&D stuff that you guys are doing at Jiro. If you were to kind of give advice to somebody wanting to buy a helmet, what would be the best way? Like, where would you, like, set them to go? Like, what would be your best advice to educate them on this newest technology?
So we actually have a website, helmetfacts.com, which is a pretty good resource. Virginia Tech as well is a great third-party resource there. When you're buying a helmet, one of the most important things that people don't consider is fit. Like, a helmet that fits you right is going to be safer than something that's too big or too small. So that's really the most important thing. Don't buy it online. Go into a shop, try it on, make sure it fits right. That's really the most critical advice I would say in terms of choosing that. And then within it, you have like helmets with rotational impact management, and realistically, something that you look cool, that looks cool to you, that you will wear, because that is more most important. That, like, the safest helmet you can have is one that you're actually going to wear.
And then if you, the price point here, there's a probably large scale of price point. What would be like your entry price point to get into, per se, a MIPS helmet?
Yeah, if you look at snow helmets, I think you would find helmets depending on what offers are out there, but starting point at $50 to $70 up to, the sky's the limit, of course. But we have a kind of a democratic view on safety. We don't want it to be the thickness of your wallet that decides if you can afford safety. So that's why we make sure that we can offer it at starting price points as well. But we have like 8 different versions of MIPS, which these different systems, they all do the same. They deliver these 10 to 15 millimeters of movement. So safety-wise, they're all at the same level, but then they have some other properties regarding weight and fit and ventilation and so. So when Steven want to build a really premium helmet, there are solutions that obstruct the fit less. He can do, it's totally free to put the vents wherever he wants. So there are different price points for sure. But in the end, we want to make sure that we cover the full price range, basically.
And so for your 15 different versions of MIPS, what would you say? Are you using one version for snow sports? Are you using another for bike? Or do we have 3 different versions that we're using based on helmet style within snow sports?
It's not 100% connected to the sport. It's more like if you have a highly ventilated road helmet, there are solutions that cater to that and are, of course, super light and doesn't almost take up any space at all. Then you have the solutions like Jiro has called Spherical, where it sits in. There you actually have 2 shells, you could say, that fits into each other in a ball and socket connection. And then the MIPS liner sits in between there.
That's a partnership between Bell and Jiro, that a patented spherical technology that revolves around the MIPS patent of having this slip plane layer. And what that does is it actually encapsulates that slip layer between the 2 EPS layers. So traditional MIPS, you have kind of touching the head form, as we call it, or straight towards your head. What this does, it moves it inboard, so you don't have that PC layer that moves back and forth. The other thing it does is it allows us to use 2 different densities of EPS foam. So the advantage there is when you have high speed impacts, we can use a denser EPS foam that crushes at a higher speed. And then low speed impacts, there's a lower density foam. So kind of 2 layers, or almost a dual spring rate, that allows you to mitigate both low speed and high speed impacts.
And you're designing You're choosing these layers based on the sport, or is that more uniform across the helmet and the price points?
So the EPS densities are chosen based on, it's kind of tuned to the helmet, and then whether it's bike or snow, it may be slightly different. There's different test standards to each one. But then, yeah, within price point, we look at the MIPS options and we tier our MIPS solutions to kind of a good, better, best story within the helmet technology. So everything has MIPS, everything will have that rotational impact management, but then at the higher level, you get the more integrated solution and more ventilation and everything that goes along with that.
Drew, do you have anything to add just as far as being a athlete, having experienced a couple of different significant head injuries? What would be your advice to someone looking to buy a helmet as far as educating, like where they can go to educate, or what would you add to that?
I mean, I think these guys nailed it. I think what I really like that you said was buy the helmet and have the helmet that you're actually gonna wear. Like, that's ultimately what it comes down to. And I think too, when we're getting into the weeds here, like, let's just get back to that. Like, wear a helmet every time you go skiing. Like, I still bring my helmet when I'm going on a little meadow skipping ski tour in case I hook a tip and there's a log underneath, you know? Like, wear the damn helmet.
Helmets are cool.
Did you throw your helmet away after your falls, Drew? Did you retire it?
I definitely retired it. Yeah, neither of those two were wearable, but I held on to them for a while. I think just from a like emotional and psychological side, I think I was just like trying to hold on and understand the meaning of those accidents. Both of them being near death scares, they had pretty huge impacts on me psychologically. But I threw them both away, which was like pretty liberating. And when I throw helmets away, I don't know if anybody else does this, but like my fear of like, it's like somebody like finds a helmet in a trash can and is like, oh sweet, I need to buy a ski helmet now. like I grab a pickaxe out of my garage and put a hole in it.
Yeah, actually. I mean, I think that's important. Like, what is your guys' suggestion to somebody who wants to buy a used helmet? I mean, sure, if that's like what you have money to do, it's better than nothing, right? But if you're trying to have the best practice, the safest practice here, what is like your safest approach there? That's reasonable.
Yeah, I think when in doubt, you throw it out. Like, we have test helmets that don't quite pass the standard, and then we crush them and we throw them away. Just for that same reason, we don't want people wearing something that's not safe or doesn't pass the standard. And if you do have a crash in a helmet and you think maybe that EPS is compressed a little bit, throw it out. And a lot of times, if you have a crash, send us an email. We'll hook you guys up with a discount code for next model.
Frederick, we were talking a little bit about that too. Like, if you've had this questionable fall, which I actually did last summit here, and I had a really hard time deciding, did I have a concussion? Am I throwing this out? I've had this helmet for 5 years. Did I have a concussion? I went over this and over this in my head. I'd look at the helmet. It all looked great. There was no scratches. What we talked about this a little bit earlier. What is the problem with that thought process?
Yeah, but I mean, you can't take a chance because you can't really see if you had a hit that compressed the EPS so much that it doesn't work anymore, or that it wouldn't take up a second hit. And I think the risk is too big to take any chances in this case. So we can't really examine the helmet, and then you had a big hit to it, then you should exchange it.
What about somebody who's like, oh my gosh, I really love this helmet. It's been my favorite. I haven't had any falls in it, but it's just a standard EPS helmet. Can I give it to you, and will you put some MIPS in it for me? Like, what would you say to that person?
It's unfortunately, we can't retrofit it into an existing helmet. As I mentioned before, like, the essence of what we do at our HQ is making sure that the system does what it was intended to do. And to do that, we have to tailor it to each specific model and each specific size. So it's simply not possible to put it there afterwards. So
And they are sticklers about that. We'll get to the point where we're testing a helmet. It's like 9.5%. And like, no, we got add sliding enablers or different things that we do to really make sure that you get that 10% improvement in rotation.
I think it's probably a good time to open the conversation out to anybody else who has any questions. Anybody have any questions here?
This question's mostly for Drew and more on the psychological part of the injuries, but for concussions and other severe season-ending injuries that are more unlucky accidents as opposed to a lack of physical training, how do you mentally tackle like coming back after that, where these things could happen again regardless of how much physical training you do?
Small question. Thanks, Max. Man, you only get one brain. And while we were talking about like that multi-impact scenario, we're thinking about whether you throw out a helmet or not, like the other reality is like wondering what happened to my brain in that crash that didn't seem that big, or maybe it was big, but I'm in denial. And I'm a very smart person. Like, I did really well in school. The only reason I wasn't valedictorian in my high school class was because I took community college classes to graduate a semester early so that I could go skiing and film ski movies. And I know enough to understand that if I hit my head really hard, there's a pretty good chance I have a concussion. Both of those severe head injuries that I talk about, I had a doctor tell me that I did not have a concussion, and despite like clearly being smart enough to be like, you know, I should take time off, I should go get a second opinion, I should figure out what's going on in here, I was still in denial that if the one doctor said I didn't have a concussion, then I should believe them and I should keep skiing. I learned the hard way what it means to only have one brain in this life, because I had those two really severe head injuries in succession. They were probably about 16 months apart, which sounds like a long time, but for an unhealed, untreated, undiagnosed brain injury, like I was really struggling. And like I said, I think the deficits from that first one are why the second one actually happened. And still after that second one, it didn't happen. And then ultimately the only reason that I got the help that I needed and that I figured out how severe those really were and that my brain was operating at a really, really compromised capacity was because I had been dealing with mental health struggles for multiple years at that point. I have type 2 bipolar disorder, and I was recovering from PTSD from that first accident, the Rockfall accident that I mentioned. And ultimately, I got to this point where I was in a depressive episode where I was suicidal beyond explanation. Like, I was doing everything right to take care of myself in this depressive episode and to come out of it, and nothing was keeping me from like the brink of suicide. And only because of getting to that point is when my therapist said we need to revisit the concussion aspect, and only because of that I was able to actually get the medical help that I truly needed, which is very difficult to receive when we're talking about neurology. And I'm very fortunate that I lucked out and found a fantastic neurologist. All of that said, is like going through all of that, I've learned what it really means to have only one brain. It was not very long ago that I was in brain rehab and questioning if I would ever be able to hold down a job again, let alone if I would be able to ski, if I would be able to have a ski career anymore. None of that is worth the benefit of continuing to ski or, you know, any sport whatsoever. And as far as like more to the core of your question of when something that severe happens, whether, you know, whether we're talking about our brains or talking about orthopedic injuries, it's devastating when we build our lives around these sports and around these pursuits and get so much of our joy and purpose and passion in life through it. But again, we only got one brain, only got one body, and only got one life. And ultimately, like, psychologically, you're going to be able to make it through that period if you focus on that bigger picture. And I think it's a lot harder to see when you have a one-track mind set on sport and when you're younger too. But life is long, and ski season's really long. You got a lot of ski seasons left in this life, kind of regardless of climate change, if you chase where weather gets more erratic too.
Drew, I think you really bring up a good point here, though, from a medical standpoint. And I'm just curious where this falls into how you guys are designing your helmets. The topic of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, right? And that's from head injury that hasn't initially healed. So you're having compounded head injury. And I'm curious what your design and how you guys are going to move through. And or, like, are we going to see less of that chronic traumatic encephalopathy the more this helmet technology is going to be replacing what we have standardly had, just foam EPS helmets?
Yeah, so I think to build on what you were saying, like, the CTE issue, it's not only the concussions, it's the subconcussive impacts that build up over time. And so that's where you're like, you hit your head kind of hard, and maybe you don't have a concussion, but that's a drop in the bucket, and then a drop in the bucket, and it adds up over your lifetime. And like, that's where they're doing all the research on the football side and potentially not having tackle football until high school because of that, because it's so additive. And so on our side, that's where we're really focusing on the low speed impacts, because we have this threshold of, we have to prevent skull fracture. And so that really, it mandates a somewhat stiff helmet, a stiff EPS and a hard shell, to make sure that you're mitigating that super worst case scenario impact. But then all of those small impacts along the way, how do we also have this low density layer that mitigates all of these tiny little impacts along the way, so you have less of that additive impact over time? And I don't know if they've done research yet on, like, the rotational element of that too, because I think a lot of it's very linear based and brain bruises. I think the next step is, okay, how does the rotational element add up over time?
Frederick, do you have anything to add?
I think Stephen said it perfectly, so nothing on top of that.
All right, next question.
So I was going to talk about an experience I have with a helmet, but after hearing what Drew was talking about, I wanted to mention that I had a head-on collision in a car accident where I was knocked out cold and head injury, and I had a bunch of doctors tell me I went from being a person who had never had an anxious event in his life to having full-on anxiety attacks, like crippling. And I had doctors tell me that wasn't related to the concussion and that wasn't part of that. But, like, I knew that was part of that, because, like, that is the only thing that could possibly be a part of it. So really a lot of dangers with head injuries, and it's a really, like, awful place to be for something that's out of your control. So you want to try to prevent that as much as you can. And then I also wanted to say that when I was 17, I fell from essentially what was standing skiing, and I cracked my Giro 99 helmet off my head, and I lost my memory that whole day, and had a severely severe concussion, and I fully believe I would be dead if I wasn't wearing that helmet that day. So just wanted to impress, like, Drew had some really serious crazy things happen, like a gigantic rock fell on your head, but you could, you know, out on the ski slope, you could fall in the wrong spot from standing, and you could be destroyed from that. So, you know, take it seriously.
Thanks, guys. I wanted to hear a little bit more about practically, when should I replace my helmet? I've heard things like, if your buddy bumps it off the table onto a tile floor, even if it's not scuffed, it's like, you know, time to get the pickaxe out. And if you have things like sensors like accelerometers and gyroscopes built into the helmet or attached to your head, could you actually like know like, oh, that just went above like above the threshold, time for a new one?
I think like time-wise, we generally say 3 years is the threshold that you should replace a helmet. Knocking it off the table, that's a tough one, right? Because it also goes into the type of helmet. We design injection molded shells to be more durable. That's your kid's helmet where 8-10 year olds are throwing their helmets on the ground, they're dropping on the concrete, and we intentionally design them to be more durable, which then makes them a little bit heavier. On the flip side, like our touring helmets, our PC in mold, they're super lightweight, which also makes them a little more fragile. So that, if you drop it off the roof of your car and it drops in the parking lot, probably get a new one for sure. So it is very subjective, but I think when in doubt, send us an email, we'll get you code and get a new one.
But there also, you can add to that also what the helmet is exposed to. I mean, if you have a bicycle helmet that you commute with every day to work, it will be exposed to a lot more UV light, and that will affect the EPS in the helmet. So then maybe you should consider replacing it at an earlier stage. And if you have a ski helmet that you use one week a year and otherwise have it tucked away in the basement, maybe it lasts a bit longer. So you have to judge that a bit also, how exposed it has been.
So just to wrap up, thanks guys for being here. I think we did a really good job of pulling in kind of what it looks like in the field from a professional athlete's perspective and kind of how you guys are designing helmets. I'd be curious to see like how many years, months, I don't know, probably more years, will we be not seeing, or will we be seeing helmets that are just out of foam without any rotational helmet technology?
I think that will last, unfortunately, for forever maybe, but I mean, to bring in a system to manage these forces, of course you need to add something to a helmet, and that will eventually come with some sort of a cost, and there will always be someone trying to put the cheapest possible product out on the market, and then they will cut that corner and deliver that helmet. So that's probably a battle that will not go away, but I mean, helmet brands are progressing really fast, and I mean,
from our side, we're moving to put MIPS in all of our Giro helmets. So right now, we do have helmets in the line with and without MIPS. Next year, right now, we're working on revamping our entry level high volume helmet that we sell at rental shops, and that one in the future will be MIPS only. We'll have rotational management in all of our helmets in the future. For other brands, can't speak to that, what shows up on Amazon, but from a Giro standpoint, we'll have rotational impact management on all of our helmets in the future.
Any last thoughts, Drew?
Helmets are cool. Wear them. I want to add one thing, too, is it's really cool that we're talking about helmets. It's really cool that we're wearing helmets. And I want these conversations to continue, not just for helmets, but for brain health in general, in action sports and in skiing and snowboarding, because that's how you are going to help people like we've heard from tonight. It's how you're going to help people like me. It's how you're going to make it expected and cool that you're not just wearing a helmet, but that you're wearing a really quality helmet, and that we're appreciative to manufacturers who are creating higher standards, and we're holding them to them. So wear the helmet.
Well, that's it for this edition of Gear 30. I want to say thanks to Sasha for hosting a great conversation. Thanks to the strikingly handsome Justin Bob for producing this episode. And thanks to all of you for listening. Speaking for our entire team here at Blister, we hope you have a fantastic weekend. And I will catch you on Monday over on our Blister podcast for a very different and very interesting conversation. I'm really looking forward to sharing that one with you. So I will catch you all on Monday over on our Blister podcast. Bye, everybody.